Ladies and gentlemen,
Excellent.
it's my distinct pleasure to welcome you all to this Lauterpacht Center Friday lunchtime lecture. As always, we acknowledge the generous sponsorship of Cambridge University Press. And why am I so happy? It's because a dear colleague and friend, Professor Antje Wiener, who holds the chair in political science and global governance at the University of Hamburg, where she is a member not just of the Faculty of Political and Social Sciences, but also of the law faculty. Antje is an elected bifellow at my own college, Hughes Hall, and has been for almost a decade. She helped us design, for example, our recent research focus on climate law, and we are very, very grateful to her. She's a member of the Academy of Social Sciences and a member of the Academia Europaea. Her research, which she will share with us today, focuses on norm research and contestation theory. She has taught in many, including UK universities, for example, Queen's University Belfast, but also University of Bath and Sussex. And currently, and those of you who attended our climate mitigation workshop will know, she's also a leading member on the contested climate justice in sensitive region of the Cluster of Excellence on Climate, Climatic Change, and Society at the University of Hamburg. So without any further ado, also a warm welcome to our online audience. If you have any questions, please put them into the Q&A tab on your Zoom screens. But with that, welcome, Professor Wiener.
Thank you very much, Markus. I'm very glad to be back at the Lauterpacht Center and very honored to have been invited to give this lecture. I'll invite you to come. This is really a conversation. So you'll see I'm not going to be reading text. I'll talk you through this. I'll be talking about global reordering and I have the slash there through norm contestation, and I promise to also provide a methodological stock take. Lots of things are going on in the world at the moment, and we can't really, I mean, contestation is pretty much everywhere, and we sometimes wonder about the norms that guide us in this, and which norms are valid to whom. And I want to contribute a little bit to this kind of to alleviate us from that confusion. So I talk about kind of chemical research. I'm just currently drafting a new research grant application here at the Lauterpacht Center. Then I want to introduce a shift from norms towards order. Then I refer to the promised methodological stocktake. That's kind of talking about discipline of international relations. And then I provide a brief outlook on paths to participation. So what are we talking about? Contestation is actually quite normal. It has always been there, and it is actually quite necessary in order to constitute order. So contestations typically take place in formal environments, we know in courtrooms and committees, and we actually work about that and with that all the time. And also in informal gatherings, be it in social movement, political meetings, and so on. And so the good thing about contestations for me as a social scientist is that they are interactive practices and therefore retraceable. I can find them in deliberations, negotiations, interpretations, arguing or debate around events. And so that's kind of then the data I can use. And they are constitutive for global order. And at the same time, stations generate change dynamics. Mostly, change dynamics have been transformative in a welcoming way towards establishing as a liberal. But we'll see in a moment, this is kind of, whilst they are transformative, they are not always normal in that sense. So we also observe deep contestations which occur when fundamental rules of politics are contested. And we have seen these, in more or less blatant manners, both in and with regard to the European regional order and with the liberal international order coming out of the world's oldest democracies from their in part from the leading politicians. So deep contestations then raise novel questions about the salience of liberal norms. Do they actually last as foundational elements of the liberal order itself? And we don't know yet whether this is degenerative or constructive, or whether there is an enabling transformative change for the United Nations Charter order. You'll see this throughout the year. I refer to the United Nations Charter order rather than the liberal international order. International order in my reading is something that is much more limited, whereas the United Nations Charter order is something where the majority of nations came together. We have related associated orders, and this brings various disciplines together. And as you know, I have been working with lawyers, and to me, that's kind of the order I find is kind of the reference point where we need to understand what do we take further of that order and to actually think about changing elements of that order. So what I actually look at, and I come from non-research in international relations, the state of the art is really that we have in international relations, we have generated much more knowledge about a norm. How does the norm change? How does the norm sort of develop further? Is it stable? Does it contribute to resilience? And so on. But what we don't really know a lot about is the order itself and how the norm and the order hang together. So I see a research gap to which my project asked, like, what is the effect of change dynamics generated by crisis-driven contestations of fundamental norms on global order? We have heard a lot about the global polycrisis, which triggered contestations both in domestic and global orders. And the question has been raised, and I've been part of another research project with the with Scripps Excellence Cluster in Berlin, contestations of the liberal script, where we have actually addressed this question of deep contestation with a lot of the norm scholars. And this question is kind of an open question. And I want to think about the order and its question of foundation element. I want to take you to an excourse, speaking with Hirschmann. Kind of the type of contention that we see at the moment, it may actually mean to do away with the contract that we are operating under at the moment. Is that under challenge? Is that an issue? Do we throw out the entire contract, our United Nations Charter order in this case, or is it kind of, do we need to look at parts of the agreement? Do other forms of agreement take its place? And I would argue that rather than throwing out the entire contract, let's zoom in on contestations of core elements of that order. And that's really, we need to understand who's involved and what are the dynamics that are generated there. And so we're tracing contestations and evaluating claims made by affected stakeholders. So let me just briefly say something on the concept of affected stakeholders, because especially critical IR types and social scientists don't like the concept because it sounds too operational and sort of managerial. But what I really mean when I talk about affected stakeholders, I look at the God omnis tangit principle, what touches all must be approved by all. And therefore, we have a stake in the norms of global governance that govern us. And in order to make that stake, since we come from everywhere, there's a claim must be made publicly about how these norms affect an individual or a group of stakeholders. That's why I work with affected stakeholders. It's like for lawyers, we know that law is made in courtrooms around the world, but we cannot be at every single courtroom. We don't know about every single courtroom. So we need to have an access point. Why do we actually listen to this particular conversation? So it must be a public claim. So let me just go into a note on contract. This goes back to some traveling that I did last year in New Zealand and Australia and Canada. And thinking about contract is something that where I invite people to go into the context of philosophy and political theory. A social contract is, it sounds as if it were negotiated, you know, like a business contract. But a social contract is so much more. It's really an expression of something that is taken to be an agreement amongst leading social groups in a particular historical context. And here we have the work of Carol Pateman, for example, basically said, look, the social contract that was supposedly agreed in the past centuries, 18th century, 19th century, huge literature about that, that was really a sexual contract because it was agreed under the conditions of patriarchy. So what then the option is at this particular time is contracting into something that has been agreed, but not by the affected stakeholders. So we need to understand when we're talking about contract, I'll say something about how the global contract fits in there. We need to understand that there's a context of historical structures and hidden patterns where we, with Carol Pateman, social contract, it was the context of kind of patriarchy that structured social relations. What about colonialism? It's not really part of the IR norms research that I'm looking at. It's not really part of when somebody is teaching international law, kind of, shall we say, in international law 101. But it's lurking in the background, and we don't really know how to actually deal with it. And so if we think about just as a thought experiment, if we think about contracts in context, and if the social contract is really effectively a sexual contract, then maybe the global contract is a colonial contract. And what does that actually mean when we think in terms of contract and contestations? I just want to keep this in the back. I'm not an expert on social contract. I'm not an expert on colonialism, but I'm interested in who has the right to actually defend their claims in a global context, and did they have the opportunity to do it? So what does contracting mean? As Carol Pateman says, contract is far from being imposed from patriarchy. Contract is the means through which modern patriarchy is constituted. Keep the analogy in mind. So is a contract then really an endpoint or a starting point? And what does it, let us start with? What is it, kind of a closure or an opening? So what is it about international law then? And I turn to Sunya Pahuja, who has actually spoken here and given the Lauterpacht lectures when I was here, and I had the privilege to listen to her 6 years ago. And I was very taken by the way that she kind of contextualized international law. And she said, what is it about international law that makes it simultaneously so full of promise, and yet again and again, a contributor to the failure of projects articulated in its name? So there is some hope. And I looked at other some texts and to see, maybe it's not all full of doom and gloom, and so there might be a way to this, what I would hope, mid-range approach to participation, pathways to participation. So she further says many critiques from the North and South maintain strong faith in international law. despite firmly comprehending its complicities with powerful actors, both historical and current. So what this critical faith suggested to her was that international law itself has a dual quality. So we need to look at the qualities. It's not just black letter. We need to understand and interpret and see where, what's the dynamic. So when you take this further, looking at interpretation, then to me, this speaks very well to a rationale that, that in international relations, we call the practice of politics, Immanuel Arndt, a sort of a that practice turn, very important practice generate norms, values, communities, and so on. So that is, and I return to Hooja, and I quote, when international law operates in the world, it does not simply meet a set of pre-existing categories that must be slotted into its logic. Rather, it produces its own subjects as well as the objects of the rule. So there is a constructive element to it. I know for sometimes for sort of more mainstream lawyers, the constructive force vis-a-vis the law is not always visible. But even colleagues like with whom I used to work on European law a lot, like Armin von Burg-Dandy, will always say that the law is socially constructed. Of course, it's done by people. It's framed in a particular way, and that makes us follow it or not. But it's still socially constructed, and therefore it can always be changed, not cast in stone. So let's move on with the practice. Politics of practice allow for, and I'm here again with the international relations people, a novel configuration of practices on that, that lead into settled orders. And how do we arrive at these settled orders? And that's kind of something where I'm coming back to my project. Whose practices count then? And whose practices ought to count if norms lie in the practice? I refer there to the book that, that I was working on when I was here the last time. And this kind of takes me forward in terms of practicing contestations and looking at the co-constitution of normative change that comes out of these practices. Now, let me look at somebody who found actually a less optimistic view on international law, and that's really, that's Rabi Ranganathan, who's a director here at the center. And she, in her work on UNCLOS, she basically, she found that apart from what was there written and contracted, there were narratives that were kind of arising through the conversations. And she notes that distinct rationales have been strategically linked with the global North and global South, respectively. And she writes, and I quote, we see emerging alongside a simpler, rather familiar narrative, which casts damaging attributes of the South engagement alone. The North stances were made legible, contextualized by reference to rational economic interests and domestic factors. The Souths were reduced either to naive ideology, out-of-date information, or worse, professional incompetence, poor comprehension, and desires for self-aggrandizement. Now, this is, of course, much more pessimistic, but in my view, both work well together because we need to understand the context, the contract that is made within the context and the knowledge that kind of drives these contexts and the confidence with which we go on then to the next conference. And it's, it tells me a little bit that I need to know more about the how for order construction. So from norms to order, the shift in my field, that would be a shift of objective in norms research from the single norm, studying the single norm, to how norms actually hang together. And this is where I come in with Boktake today after this little excursus about contextualization. So I look at distinct practices of contestation and norm implementation, diffusion, change of norm, and so on. That's kind of what IR norm research has studied as normal contestation, the stuff that we need in order to actually understand how a norm works. That's not particularly exciting. It was very exciting for IR scholars that all of a sudden states changed their behavior because of norms, but that was 30 years ago. And so contestation is the bread and butter for norm implementation and compliance in international politics. But of course we see these days that not all governments care about norm implementation anymore. And so that really, that's a moment where we see that what Ren Herschel and Heike Krieger have sort of have picked up on and said, well, international, the sides of international become kind of mega political sides. So it's really about how norms are implemented or laws that we need to look kind of beyond the contract itself. So that's this kind of pushes me towards this question, how do norms hang together? Look at crisis-driven contestation, change dynamics, and then analyze the transformative effects on global ordering. And this is where I want to go now. So we start with disruptive contestations. Where do they take place? Clearly not, as we were often told, in the global south, but including Europe and North America. Who are the contestants? We have obviously skeptics of globalization and had that for a long time on the political left, but we have increasingly nationalist populist on the political right. And so what are contested? Foundational elements of the liberal international order, foundational elements of the United Nations Charter order, foundational elements of the European Union and other regional orders. And we have seen that in the press, but we don't really know what to make of it. I would still, given that context is so important, I have made the point that these deep contestations don't necessarily all have to be bad, have a negative effect. Maybe they are also, given that we operate in a particular context, maybe they are required. Maybe we need to think about the foundations, the foundation elements of certain aspects of the global order. So what are these foundational elements? We're looking at elements rooted in distinct orders, like principles, fundamental norms, and rules. We look at crisis-driven deep contestations to understand the dynamics and ages. And I say something about that when I look at the methods in the next section in a moment. And the procedural elements that we need to be contested in order for a liberal order or a legitimate order to actually function are participation, contestation, deliberation, litigation, these practices. Those are our kind of normal contestation. So here we basically need to look at which procedures are in place. And but we get concerned when the procedure itself is contested and shifts towards being disruptive foundational contestation. So the research gap then is single norm cases towards the bigger picture. My question is, as I said, to repeat in the beginning, how do norms construct together? I'm not interested in whether or not a norm is robust. That is an intrinsically uninteresting research question because a norm is counterfactual. If a norm might not be followed, but it might be referred to all the time. So those who are the strongest contesters of kind of military intervention, of security, of human rights, of torture, they contribute to the robustness of the norm in the sense that it is there, it is referred to, people look at it, but it does not necessarily tell us anything about whether in detail the norm is implemented in practice or whether it changes the normal structure, how we actually perceive of torture. We have talked about that case, especially in reference to the United States, waterboarding and so on for quite a while. So I don't want to just to look at whether a norm is, but I want to see actually how the norm hang together. How do human rights, as we found in the workshop earlier this week, how do human rights, for example, hang together with climate justice? And what does it mean for security? That's what I find more important. So So I want to look at these three, rule of law, climate and security, as crisis-driven context of incidents. So my methodological stocktake, I have a few minutes to go with that. And this will just lead you into it's a toolbox. If it's boring from your aspect, then you might simply overlook it, but I find it very important to understand in which ways we actually look at norms, and we can only talk to each other when we know what the other scholar is actually doing. So this stocktake entails kind of four steps towards an umbrella framework, and I'll talk you very briefly through each a quarter of this cake before we have it. So we start with, so these are the four, I start with a norm typology, norm contestation, norm constellation, pathways of participation, and of course the fourth quadrant is open and to be further investigated. So with the typology, we need typologies. Typologies help us to approach a complex subject. So when we look at norm types, let me just take the example of climate justice. Type one would be a macro scale of global warming. It would be a fundamental principle, for example, climate justice. And I look at it from the perspective of contestation. Is it likely to be highly contested or likely to be very sort of little contested? Do people not care how much contestation do we actually need in order to implement it? So what you see here is the moral reach of fundamental principles is very high. People will immediately say, oh yeah, climate justice is a good thing, great. Human rights, democracy. People will accept that this is something that you ought to appreciate. So you will have a very low reactive contestation. People will not oppose human rights in the first place. But you require a lot of proactive contestation in order to actually make it work. You need to sort of see what kind of adjacent norms do you require, procedure standards in order to actually put the norm into place. So here's type two, the means of organizing principle that comes in. That's the norm that we are actually looking at because it's a hybrid norm. It usually follows out of the process of iterated interactions where people understand like common but differentiated responsibility for the field of climate politics or the responsibility to protect. There is an understanding that a shared responsibility is required, but there's always an aspect that is open where it needs to be negotiated on a case-by-case basis on how to actually implement the norm. So this is where we have a moderate moral reach for the principled aspect, and we have also a possibility of proactive and required sort of need for proactive contestation where we know we have been engaging before to understand what it is. We have agreed in principle that there is a responsibility, but we need to implement it on a case-by-case basis. So that's the norm we're looking at, and that's a norm that we don't find in all sectors. And type three is just standards, example, emission standards, temperature rise, and so on, where stakeholders will basically have the option to say, I don't want it, I'm not with it, contested compliance, the moral reach is relatively low. So these are just the three types that help us navigate through on which kind of scale of knowledge engagement are we there. And so the pathways that I'm looking at, pathways to participation, are expected to emerge around the meso scale. We have developed a series of assumptions about these, drawing on the typology. When you start with, given the broad moral reach and high recognition of type one fundamental norms, then they generate low reactive and high proactive contestation. So we can expect that. And that's then how we can actually deal with them. The type two are origin and shared practices and politics or policymaking. So These norms are already shared by a group, normally policymakers and international organizations or committees and so on. And so the degree of reactive and proactive contestation is balanced, which is what we actually require for good politics. It leads towards compromise and possibility. And then the third one is really a norm where we already have a high degree of formalization and a very thin moral reach, and therefore we can expect a reaction objection to the norm. But that's kind of the way that you operate with when looking at norms in order to understand what kind of contestation is normal and what would be sort of deep here. So let's move on to the next part. That's the norm contestation. Once I know that it's there, how do I trace it? Zoom in on the practice. We look at the kind of the cycle, a grid model where we have sites with reference to the stage of norm implementation, the constitution of norms, negotiating norms, implementing norms, and then the reference to the scales of international order. So we've kind of nine ideal typical sites. I don't have to go into too much detail here, but it's important that if you look at the cycle, the stakeholders that are affected, in the best case scenario, they have access to formal validation, social validation, and cultural validation of a norm. But in most cases, if you look at site number nine on the right-hand bottom, most individuals will only have their cultural validation, their idea of what a norm is, and they have very little power because the norm will affect them at the implementing stage. On the other hand, when you're looking at stage one, macro scale, you have representatives of state and government who are actually constituting the norm, setting them in the first place. So what we have here, and I'll summarize the practices of validation here. In the best case scenario, you have again the pathways, kind of stage two on the meaningful level, where a larger group of stakeholders is able to negotiate about sort of the norms that the meaning of the norm that are effective for them. Now, what we then look at, and this is where we come into a kind of a new area looking at order, the norm constellation, the constellation of various norms and how they hang together. And this is something which has not been done yet, but I draw on this polycentric norm of order. It's kind of an institutional macroscope that you generate from the data following the processes of contestation and people's reference to contestation. And I just have put these climate, rule of law, and security contestations in this global institutional macroscope where we look at the semantics of normative norms and see, and then can play with, you imagine, hundreds of kind of interactions between stakeholders that contribute to the meaning of norm, and you see kind of the larger points will be norms that matter more and that come up in more conversations, and the smaller points might be more sort of adjacent norms that also come up. And this is really something which I have not done yet for these norms. We have done it with regard to climate, but I haven't done it with regard to the global order. But the interesting aspect here for us is then, and I think in terms of the question I raised in the beginning, what happens with the global contract, the United Nations Charter order? What happens, for example, if I take the rule of law out of this institutional macroscope? Will it actually entirely collapse, or will we find a lot of the elements of the rule of law with climate and security? Will we see a shift in importance and maybe in practices from one major nation norm of the global order towards another? This is something which we can find out with reference to semantic mapping, the densification of norms. And the idea is here to construct, set up an observatory with international experts and take this observatory to different regions around the world. It's the idea is not to kind of go to The Hague in the first place, or to sort of stick to the main locations of where the order, international order, was signed, but to go to the regions, places in the global north and the global south, and see how the norms, sort of the semantics, play out. So this opens, and I'm almost done here, this opens kind of the aspect where the analysis comes in once the data is generated, which I haven't done yet, where we look at pathways of participation. And this would be the outlook where, coming back to what I said, and which I kind of identified as the mesoscale, the challenge of enabling proactive contestation as much as possible so as to enhance the perceived legitimacy of the norms that govern us, coming back to the quod omnes tangit principle. So with all types of contestation, in principle, being sort of norm generative, it is through proactive contemplation, where we critically engage with the norm in the knowledge that we actually have a possibility of changing them, that sort of widely legitimate norms are likely to emerge. So future research then is set to identify pathways of participation in order to facilitate the institutional means to proactive contestation. And this leads me to the next event on Monday, where we actually present the other book that is kind of has been very influential as a background for this talk, has just been published in September together with my colleague, Phil Orchard, and which has political scientists and international legal scholars in it. So we talk about that next week at UCL. So thank you very much.